Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher, back with another season of the global number one podcast, The Girlfriends. Last time, we investigated the murder of Gail Katz. This time, we're uncovering the identity of the woman who was buried in Gail's grave for a decade before she disappeared. Join me and the rest of the club as we tell her story. Listen to season two of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
As important as choosing the right destination when traveling is choosing the right travel partner.
Gene!
Eugene Fodor!
Gene, was good!
But be careful, because the worst trips result when two partners have two different agendas.
The CIA really need your help, Gene.
Freeze, Americano!
Gene, run!
Listen to Fodor's Guide to Espionage on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robay,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
I am so excited about this podcast, The Bright Side. You guys are giving people a chance to shine a light on their lives, shine a light on a little advice that they want to share.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
Every family has an origin story, one passed down through the generations. Mine happens to be a mystery involving my great-great-grandmother left behind in Sicily. I'm Joe Piazza, and my new podcast will transport you to the gorgeous island of Sicily as I trace my roots back through a whodunit for the ages. Listen to The Sicilian Inheritance on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, welcome to Weird House Cinema. This is Rob Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick, and today we are hopping into the world of Taoist sorcery, Hong Kong monsters, glutinous rice, martial arts, and much more with our very first Zhangqi movie. I've been wanting to do one of these movies for a while because I had never actually seen a Zhangqi film, and I was aware of them for a while, I've seen like pictures of them on the internet. So this has been in my mind for years, and finally we got to see one. Today we're going to be talking about Mr. Vampire.
Yeah, I'm excited as well because I think I was in the same boat as you. I knew about Zhangqi. I knew they existed in Chinese folklore as being this kind of vampire, kind of zombie creature with unique characteristics all their own. But I'd never watched a Zhangqi movie. Though, interestingly enough, this was before you brought up the idea of doing one. I had picked up the new Dungeons and Dragons book, Van Richten's Guide to Ravenloft, and it includes a domain in it inspired by Chinese mythology and folklore. So it includes stats for Zhangqi monsters. In Dungeons and Dragons, it's a ninth level undead entity with the power to drain the energy of its victims and a shapeshift.
So Zhangqi is both a class of Chinese mythological monster and a specific genre of especially 1980s Hong Kong martial arts comedy films.
That's correct. Yeah, and this is one of the big films. We started looking around like, well, which Zhangqi movie should we do? And the signs increasingly pointed to Mr. Vampire from 1985 because it was a huge hit. It was responsible for really popularizing it in not only within Chinese cinema and creating a whole subgenre, but also spreading out. It was very popular in Japan and ultimately, you know, across to the West as well. So, and also this is the one we could rent from our local video store, Videodrome.
Yeah, these movies are not widely digitally available, at least that I could find. But
at least not right now. I feel like they have been recently, but I have to say Amazon Prime used to be my go-to place for a lot of weird movies, but I feel like they're selection is not as expansive as it was just a couple of years ago.
So Mr. Vampire is really a title that sort of grabs me by the fangs or by the fingernails, as it may be, to begin with. There's something a little bit cheeky about it, but also I think this is not a direct translation of the original title, which I think in the Cantonese original title was, it translates to like hold your breath for a moment or something.
Yeah. And that, and the reason for that is because that's one of the plot points. And how do you avoid the Zhangxi discovering where you are and draining the life out of you? Well, just don't breathe and then it can't detect your presence. But Mr. Vampire, that also kind of works. It's not the name of a vampire in it, but it's referring to our main character, who is a Taoist priest whose expertise is the management and sometimes slaying of vampires, and therefore he's Mr. Vampire, in the same way that someone who comes and fixes your pipes might be Mr. Plumbing or Mr. Plumber.
I was thinking of it more along the lines of Mr. Coffee, like he is a machine that is designed to perfectly execute this function. And so in this case, our hero in the film, the Taoist priest played by Qin Ying Lam, is the machine that perfectly executes the Zhangxi cycle.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk for just a little bit about the Zhangxi, because some of you may be super familiar with this already. Maybe you've read the new Ravenloft book, and so, you know, you're like, I know all the stats, Rob, you don't have to go into the details, but I will anyway, because it's super interesting, and I think it enhances our understanding of this film. Even though this film is very much a horror comedy, it's not like it has, I think, you know, really deep things to say, but it is a treatment of a monster that emerged out of Chinese history, out of Chinese folklore, and out of real anxieties. So first of all, Zhangxi literally means the stiff or the rigid dead, and the reason for that will become clear when we start talking about how they move, especially. So I'd love to just set the scene for you here, if I may.
Okay, let's get it.
Imagine yourself out on a road, so frustratingly close to the walls of the city you've been traveling to, and yet night is falling, the mist is rolling in, and then up ahead you see several figures in the gloom. Who are they? Are they fellow travelers, perhaps headed to where you're going, or coming from the opposite direction? Maybe they're a patrol of guards from the city, and you even entertain the possibility that they might be bandits, but then they do something quite unnatural. They hop. They hop like creatures whose legs are bound or stiff with rigor mortis, perhaps even forgetful of proper bipedal locomotion and forced to lunge themselves forward through physical space like a writhing worm stood on end. The creatures hop, and they hop again, ever closer to you. And as they get closer, you see that they are undead horrors dressed in robes from the Qing Dynasty, decayed corpses burning with unnatural life. And as they hop, they reach out towards you with elongated fingernails. They gasp with bloody fang-toothed jaws, and if they catch you, they will drain every last ounce of precious qi from your body.
Ooh, I got the shivers.
Yeah, the thing about the hopping, really, the hopping is key, because it's such a vital part of the folklore, and yet at the same time, it can seem ridiculous because it is so unnatural, and sometimes it's hard for us to really like figure out like at what point does the unnatural become the ridiculous? At what point does the ridiculous then become the uncanny?
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I mean, I won't deny that it looks funny in the movie when they're hopping, and it clearly is supposed to look funny in the movie because this isn't like a straight horror movie. This is a horror comedy. But I can see how the hopping could be quite unnerving given the right cultural associations and if it were, I don't know, maybe if it were filmed from the right angle, too.
Right.
Because, like, you can get the funny aspects, like it's kind of a sack race zombie, right? It's just the feet can't move independently. It's hopping up and down with the arms outstretched. But on the other hand, it symbolizes that this body no longer works as it should. In fact, it is no longer really a human body, but something else.
Exactly. So that's the Zhangxi. But as most of you know from listening to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, monsters don't just exist in a vacuum. Monsters always mean something. And so I was curious, like I know a number of you are curious, where does this come from? What does it mean? What is the hopping all about? Why does the rigor mortis seem to be so key to this depiction of the undead? And I looked at a few different sources, and then I found this paper by historian Joo-Hee Soo. And it's actually their Doctor of Philosophy dissertation at Washington University from 2019, but it's titled The Afterlife of Corpses, A Social History of Unburied Dead Bodies in the Qing Dynasty, 1644 through 1911.
Interesting. So what can you tell us about these creatures?
Okay, so while Chinese mythology and folklore is filled with various ghosts and monsters, obviously, the Zhengxi seem to emerge out of a Qing dynasty crisis concerning the burial of the dead. So Su writes that numerous records from the 18th and 19th century discuss the problem of unburied bodies left on the ground without proper burial. And the interesting thing is these were not exclusively, say, the victims of war or famine or disaster, you know, something where even in the best of situations can overwhelm your ability to deal with the dead.
Right.
They were seemingly, for the most part, individuals who simply had no permanent grave. And this, Sue writes, was due to changing socioeconomic structure during this time period and the resulting imbalance between population and arable land.
Interesting.
Yeah. So, I mean, the idea here is that a family would need a secure claim to the land in order to bury a deceased loved one. And if a grave could not be obtained, then they were then the body would just be left out or would be, abandoned or lost, not necessarily like immediately discarded, but it might be put somewhere. And then it would never find its way to a permanent destination.
This actually plays into the movie. I hadn't thought about this, but in the plot of Mr. Vampire, though, again, this is a comedy movie, mm-hmm. part of the incitement of the vampire curse in this film seems to be a dispute about over the land on which a body is buried. That there's like a dispute between this wealthy family, this wealthy family with this businessman patriarch and a fortune teller who originally wanted access to some kind of burial plot. And the businessman bought it off the fortune teller, seemingly with some kind of coercion for the purchase, because it was said to be a very lucky place to bury a body that would bring great fortune to the future generations of the family. But obviously the fortune teller who was forced to sell the land didn't like this. And so a dispute about land rights and the burial of the body seems to be at the root of whatever black magic causes the vampire to begin with.
Yeah, and that plays right into this historical setting out of which it emerges, this idea that land in which you can properly bury the dead and do the dead justice is in short supply, and not everyone has the access that they once enjoyed to it. And while the Sue writes that while the Zhengnan region was most impacted by this situation, it became an empire-wide crisis because it wasn't just about the dead and dealing with the dead, but a perceived cultural decline in funeral custom and even a decline in devotion to one's ancestors, which has enormous cultural significance.
Well, this is another thing I would say in Mr. Vampire. Again, it's hard to say because the movie, I would say, is ultimately it's a light comedy. You know, it's light horror martial arts comedy. So it's not getting too serious about anything. But I kind of detect a strain of critique of modernity in it generally. And it's set during, so it was made in the 1980s, but it's set during the Republican period of China. So in the first half of the 20th century. And in it, there seems to be a sort of a critique of a modern, maybe Western influenced way of living.
There's a very comedic police officer who seems to embody all the negative attributes of the police. Like he is abusive and stupid and, you know, is framing the wrong guy for the murder, is not addressing any problems. And so there's this idea that the government and the law is not maintaining any the necessary order, and that this lack of order also applies to our honor to the dead.
Yeah, and so the character in the movie who wants to have his ancestor reburied, which again is one of the inciting incidents in the film, he seems to be making decisions that could be, again, I don't know exactly the right cultural way to read this, but I think it is to be interpreted as he's making decisions that are somewhat disrespectful to his own ancestors in hopes of making money.
Yeah.
Okay, well, we're maybe sort of getting ahead of ourselves here because we've started getting into the details. But Rob, what's the basic elevator pitch for Mr. Vampire before we hit the trailer audio?
All right. When Qing Dynasty vampires rise up and cause havoc in early 20th century China, again, this is Republic of China, only the Taoist priest, Master Gao, and his two assistants can stop the evil.
You know, you kind of get the sense that Master Gao would have had a better chance stopping the evil without his two assistants.
Well, it's hard to get good help in the vampire busting business.
Yes. Let's hear some audio.
冇事嘅，比文才好得多。哇，咁多咖喱鸡，呢只梗系印度鬼嚟嘅。乜你去过盐园咩？冇啊。怡红院系咩地方嚟噶？冇。茶楼啊。咩话？诶，酒家。你话咩话？诶，鸡斗。你等我。诶，小姐。
All right, so that is, I believe, from the original Cantonese trailer. So that is, if there's any language, any dialogue in that trailer that you heard, that is Cantonese. Yeah. And I recommend watching the film in Cantonese if you can. I watched about half of it dubbed and then switched over to Cantonese with subtitles, yeah, about halfway through. And I really enjoyed the original language more.
I was going to say the same thing. I watched it with the Cantonese audio with subtitles, and I think that's the better way to do it because there's a lot of the line delivery in Cantonese that is quite funny, even if you don't speak Cantonese, can't understand what they're saying. I would single out the main star of the movie, Chin Ying Lam, for some of his very funny, stern delivery of particular lines in certain scenes. Like, I really like the scene where his assistant, who is turning into a vampire, is saying, like, what's going to happen to me? And he says, your blood will stiffen. And then he says, what will happen when it stiffens? And he says, it will get hard. And the way he delivers his lines in the original language, I think, is much funnier.
Yeah, yeah. We'll get back to him, but he is indeed great in this. It's hard to imagine the film without him because his character is at once stern and serious and heroic and capable, and yet at the same time does occasionally look like a buffoon, uh-huh. as is befitting of a horror comedy. But it's a careful line to walk. Like, how do you make your hero buffoonish enough but also a capable action horror star?
I want to come back to that theme.
All right, well, let's start talking about some of the folks involved in this film, because it does have a lot of interesting people in it. First of all, let's talk about the director, who also was one of the screenwriters, Ricky Lau. Lau was born in 1949, and Mr. Vampire is his big hit. I mean, it was a huge hit. So he went on to do, and is still doing, plenty of films in this vein, including The Romance of the Vampires in 1994, and more recently, Taoist Priest, 2021, a film starring Suho Chin, one of the stars from Mr. Vampire.
Oh.
This is a trend we'll see a lot.
Who is Suho Chin in Mr. Vampire?
He's the handsome assistant, and we'll get to him in a second.
Oh, yeah, okay. Yeah, he's good.
Now, the producer on this film is also a huge name in Hong Kong cinema, though I'm to understand he was largely hands-off with Mr. Vampire. But we have to point out that Sammo Hung was the producer. And I think everybody's heard of Sammo Hung. He's one of the biggest names in Hong Kong cinema, certainly outside of Hong Kong, well, when you get into like just international cinema.
He's one of those people who you just look at a picture of him and you're like, that guy's the boss. He's the boss of something.
Yeah. Yeah. Legendary, rotund Hong Kong actor, martial artist, producer, and director. And he's been in so many things. In fact, he was in one of the other key films of this genre, the horror comedy, the Hong Kong horror comedy, and that was an Encounters of the Spooky Kind that occurred several years later. It was sort of the first big horror comedy, as I understand it.
Oh, yeah. So I also wanted to see Encounters of the Spooky Kind. I haven't seen that one either. But is it also about Jiang Shi, or is it about something else?
I am not entirely sure, but one of the same writers was involved in it. Mm-hmm. So I know that it at least has spooky stuff in it. It has encounters of the spooky kind in it, but okay. I sadly haven't seen it yet. It's really the next one I should see because it's huge and very influential.
Uh-huh.
Now, I was reading in a book called Spooky Encounters, A Guaylo's Guide to Hong Kong Horror by Daniel O'Brien. And in that, O'Brien says that Hung was in Sammo Hung was inspired by stories that his mother told him when he was a child, as well as a particular story from Pu Song Ling's Tales from a Chinese Studio, which I was excited to read because I'm really fond of Tales from a Chinese Studio. I have I think it's the Penguin Books edition, which doesn't include all of Pu Song Ling's stories and retellings of these various weird tales from China, but it has a number of them.
Now, you sent me a link to an ebook version of this that did have the story in it. And so I read this story. The story is called The Resuscitated Corpse.
Yes, I believe you're right. And it's I was impressed. So the thing about Pu Songling's stories is that they vary wildly in tone. Mm-hmm. There are some where basically just he's like, hey, this scholar from such and such city told me about this thing that once happened and it was weird. And that's the end. Mm-hmm. My son and I enjoy reading them together, and occasionally they just stop abruptly like that. It's like a man saw a fairy in the woods, the end. A man saw some fleas do a cool trick or circus performance on a backpack, the end. Mm-hmm. Other times they're longer. Sometimes they're just really grotesque and brutal, like a troll chews on somebody's skull, and then they never find out what it was about. There's a lot of never finding out what happened. Something strange happens, and no explanation is ever made. Nothing is ever really done about it. Other times, they're humorous. Sometimes they're a little bit on the raunchy side, mm-hmm. in rare instances. But this one is, I think, an example of a story that is both terrifying in parts, but also ultimately ridiculous and humorous.
Yeah. So the basic story here is that there are four travelers who arrive at, is it an inn or a house? They're on the road and they get to some place where they really need to stay for the night because the night has come on and they can't stay outside. And there's no, it must be an inn because basically there's no room at the inn. And they say, okay, well, can you give us somewhere to stay? Even if we don't have our own rooms. And so the homeowner or the innkeeper is like, well, okay, you can stay in this room with my dead daughter-in-law's corpse that hasn't been buried yet.
Right.
Very, very good. Very cool. Yeah.
And this is, of course, getting into the idea, like she hasn't been buried yet, perhaps because they have not found a place to bury her.
Right. And again, getting into these big concerns about, maybe bad magic comes on when somebody doesn't receive the right kind of ritual burial in a timely manner. Mm-hmm. So the four travelers go to sleep in the room, and then in the middle of the night, one of them wakes up and realizes that the body of the dead daughter-in-law is getting up off of the table where it's resting, and the dead daughter-in-law goes around to each of the sleeping travelers and breathes in their faces, and the breathing on them, there seems to be something very sinister about this, but eventually the one traveler who's awake while this is happening gets up and runs out, and the dead daughter-in-law is very mad about him running away, and she chases him all the way to a monastery where he bangs on the door and begs to be let in, and the priest is like, I don't know who you are, you can't come in. And so he's running around outside, he hides behind a tree, and then the zombie lady attacks him but gets her arms wrapped around the tree. Did I understand that right?
Yeah, like basically it's like she reaches to the left and he ducks to the other side, and then she reaches on that side and he ducks to the other side, and they're just going back and forth. It's like it's very much a Hong Kong martial arts comedy skit, and they do this until they're absolutely exhausted, the both of them, even the corpse. Uh-huh. And then I guess the corpse gets the bright idea, I'll just reach out and grab him on both sides of the tree at the same time.
But then what happens is her long, scary ghost fingernails get stuck in the tree. And so she's just stuck to the trees. And the next morning, the authorities come, and this resurrected corpse is stuck to the tree with her fingernails in the wood.
The end. And that's the great thing about the stories.
I think the last, I may be remembering this wrong, but I think the last line is something like, the local governor made a report of the incident.
Yes, they often that's the form of these stories. They'll often begin with saying, telling you who told you this, who told him this story, to give it, I guess, kind of, it gives it an air of authenticity, or it ends with something like that, saying like where it was recorded. Yeah. And I love it.
And then everything was fine.
So, Mr. Vampire, not a direct adaptation of that, but you can definitely see some of the connections there, some of the, the comedic horror.
Right.
All right. So, a couple of the screenwriters we're just going to blow through here kind of quickly, but they were accomplished screenwriters. There's Chukwon Sato, I believe it is, who wrote on some major Hong Kong films featuring stars such as Jackie Chan and Jet Li. There's screenwriter Barry Wong, who lived 1946 through 1992, who worked on such films as Fight Back to School, starring Stephen Chow, and two different John Woo films, Hard Boiled and The Killer, both starring Chow Yun-fat.
Well, some of the most famous of the recent, or, well, not that recent anymore, but recent decades, Hong Kong action movies.
Yeah, definitely names in Hong Kong cinema that resonate globally.
Yeah. But it's interesting to see the connection to Stephen Chow as well, because I would say in many ways, I think Stephen Chow is kind of a modern inheritor of this kind of martial arts action comedy thing with supernatural elements like we see in Mr. Vampire, not so much in the horror vein, but still supernatural fighting comedies. I'm thinking of his work in Kung Fu Hustle, I think has some inspiration points in films like Mr. Vampire, it would seem to me.
Now, the story on this film came from Ying Wong, who was born in 1968. And I don't know much about Ying Wong, but he's had his hands in a number of really cool-looking film projects, both as a writer and a director. He wrote the novel that served as the basis for 1983's Bastard Swordsman, and his other credits include Return of the Demon from 1987, which he also directed, 1990's The Swordsman, and an interesting-looking Chinese mummy movie, which just based on the cover, it looks like it involves like jade armor, like jade burial armor. Mm-hmm. And I think that one also has Ghostbusters in it, not our Ghostbusters, but in general Ghostbusters. Most notably, however, Wong co-wrote that other earlier important Hong Kong supernatural comedy, Encounters of the Spooky Kind, that starred Sammo Hung in 1980.
Okay, well, that one's still on the list for me. But yeah. I feel like we got to get to our star. We've been sort of burying the lead, as we sometimes do here, because I've just been wanting to talk about Chin Ying Lam.
Yes, he plays Master Gao, a.k.a. Mr. Vampire. He's an actor who lived 1952 through 1997. So, sadly short-lived, but boy, he acted a lot during that period. Mm-hmm. He's very much the star of this picture. He's our monobrow Taoist priest who specializes in the handling of Jiangxi and other various spirits. And he has a pretty interesting history. He started out in stunt work for the Shaw Brothers and Golden Harvest Studio. He was a personal assistant to Bruce Lee. And then he joined Sammo Hung's stunt team, and the two became friends. He'd done various roles prior to Mr. Vampire, but this was the role that really made him famous. So it should come as no surprise that he played a lot of Taoist priests who battled supernatural forces during his career. Uh-huh. I can't even begin to list them all here, but they include all sorts of Mr. Vampire-inspired films, loose Mr. Vampire spinoffs, and the Vampire Expert TV show.
So you might consider him in a way repeatedly typecast in a certain type of supernatural horror movie hero role, the way like Peter Cushing would have been in the Hammer horror movies, repeatedly playing this Van Helsing type character.
Yeah, even though like we're not even dealing with direct sequels, it's like we want that character in our film, even if we call him something else. Who are we going to get to play him? Of course, we're going to get Chin Ying Lam. Though he also did, I want to point out, it does look like he did some unrelated and serious roles as well. So, hopefully it balanced out in his career. Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astapro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astapro and go today. Astepro allergy.com. Astapro and go. Use as directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher. I'm so excited to tell you about the brand new series of The Girlfriends. In season one, we told you about the murder of Gail Katz at the hands of my ex-boyfriend, Bob. At one point, a woman's torso washed up on Staten Island and was misidentified as Gail. She spent 9 years in Gail's grave, and then she just disappeared.
It's almost like it's become this moral obligation to find her.
And that's what we're going to do. Find this missing girlfriend and tell her story. With the help of some of your favorite girlfriends from season one, like my producer, Anna.
Oh my God.
My friend, Dr. Mindy Shapiro.
Hi, it's Dr. Shapiro, and I'd like to speak with the deputy medical examiner.
And of course, Gail's sister, Elaine Katz.
Having no closure, it kills you.
Join us as we try to solve a 35-year-old cold case. It's not going to be easy, but it's going to be one hell of a ride.
What?
I can't believe this.
Listen to season two of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. New year, new name, new energy, but...
same old us. Oh, yeah.
And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. But that's not all. We will also have special guests to add their thoughts on the topics, as well as break down different political issues with local activists in their community. If you like to be informed and to expand your thoughts, listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
So in this movie, they have made a very interesting costuming and makeup decision to give our hero the sort of the unflappable, stern, competent, master Taoist priest a unibrow, as you said, a monobrow. I guess you could use either term. But I was thinking about the meaning of the unibrow in this movie. It wasn't just his natural facial hair. That is something they clearly have accented with makeup. Mm-hmm. And in American cinema, the unibrow is used exclusively for comedy, right? It's something that's supposed to look funny. And this is a comedy movie, but I don't think Master Gao's unibrow is supposed to be funny. This is a unibrow that signals an eagle-like seriousness, dignity, knowledge. It reads to me as a unibrow of respect.
Yeah, I was thinking about this, and I think you're right. It seems to be sternness. I can't really tell how comedic it's supposed to look, because it doesn't look just ridiculous. It does look like it's part of the costume, but in that respect, it's not as ridiculous as some of the hair and makeup effects that you see in certainly earlier Hong Kong cinema. Because if you see various Shaolin type films, you'll see a lot of obvious fake facial hair and long hair, whatever you can do to sort of differentiate one character from another, even if they're played by sort of the same troupe of stunt people.
Mm-hmm. Clearly, the valence of a unibrow changes with culture. I mean, again, as we said, in American movies, it is something that is always taken as funny. But there are cultures where a unibrow or monobrow is considered a desirable trait. It's considered very handsome or beautiful to have a single brow.
Yeah, it's definitely gonna range across time and space.
I think specifically, especially in some like Central Asian cultures, a unibrow is considered very desirable.
Yeah. I was looking around for any indication on what it might have meant to Chinese audiences, or if it was a statement on something that was common, you know, among, say, Taoist priests or something. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't really find an answer. I mean, you see bushy eyebrows show up in various Chinese illustrations and depictions, often attributed to gods and immortals. You know, there's a wise nature to it. But I just couldn't find anything about monobrows, other than I did see that our priest character in this film is sometimes described as something that is translated as one eyebrow priest.
Huh. Well, I'm trying to think how to read that. Does that mean more that it's just a particular trait of this one character, or that he is of a type, like the one-eyebrowed priest type?
I don't know. I mean, I wonder if there are other monobrowed Taoist priests in films that are not depicted as an homage to this film, you know?
Yeah.
I guess that's an open question.
I want to talk about another personal grooming thing that ties in interestingly with the plot, which is that both the monsters in this film and the hero have long fingernails.
Yes.
So Qin Ying Lam has these the long, sculpted, well-manicured fingernails, but also the vampires do. And the vampires not only have them, they use them to kill, sometimes in lieu of using the fangs to kill.
Yeah. Now, in our past episode on fingernails, we talked a little bit about long fingernails, particularly amid Chinese scholars in the old days. And one of the characters that came up was a poet by the name of Li He, who lived, I believe, 790 or 791 through 816 or 817 CE.
Yeah, he was a Tang Dynasty poet. I remember you found some source that described him as like the bad boy of Tang Dynasty poets. He was like a very weird poet who wrote strange, almost, this sounds like an anachronistic comment to make, but having read a lot of his poems now, I think it's sort of accurate, almost psychedelic poetry.
Talking about what owls burning with goblin fire in the forest, things of that nature.
Yeah.
And I think he did have this bad boy image, this kind of he was interested in kind of dark and mysterious and magical things.
Yes, totally. But he was also considered morbid, kind of deathly. For some reason, I'm associating him with connotations of illness and morbidity. And yet he had this very distinctive personal style that definitely included long fingernails.
The crazy thing, though, is this is not something we realized previously, but I had just looked him up to make sure I had the right individual in mind. And I pulled up the Wikipedia page on him and just did like a quick search for fingernails to make sure that I wasn't misremembering his fingernails. But the Wikipedia article not only mentions his nails, it mentions his unibrow.
What?
Yeah, apparently he was known for his unibrow, according to this Wikipedia entry. So
again, I've got to ask, is this just a coincidence? Is this tapping a broader cultural meaning in Chinese history of the unibrow? Or maybe in some way is the Taoist priest of the Mr. Vampire franchise a take on Li He?
I'm not sure. I think it'll have to remain an open question.
Just to give a taste of that psychedelicness, I just found a place where I transcribed one of his poems as translated by a Chinese poetry scholar named David Hinton, who has a wonderful collection of translations of classic Chinese poetry that I highly recommend. But Hinton's translation of one of Li He's poems called Qi In Spirit Song, I just want to read a few lines from that. It goes, "Black as your puma cat weeping blood, fox dying a cold death, an opalescent dragon on ancient walls, tail inscribed in gold, then the rain god riding it down into a lake's autumn waters, and that ancient 100-year-old owl, it's a forest demon now, sound of laughter, emerald fire rising up out of its nest."
That's beautiful. I love it.
So yeah, serious recommendation in this. If you're looking for a good collection of translations of Chinese poetry across the ages, David Hinton's book is awesome.
All right, well, let's get back to Mr. Vampire. We've discussed Master Gao, and we'll keep coming back to him. But let's talk about his two assistants. So first up, Chao Xing, the handsome one, is played by Su Hochin.
That's exactly right. He is the handsome one. I was trying to remember what his name is, like the English translation was, because they... in the subtitles, they give them English translated names, or at least one of them. The less handsome assistant is named Dan.
Yeah.
But I forget what this one's name was. But yeah, this guy is the less comedic, more competent, more martial arts competent, and just generally handsome and heroic of the two.
Yeah, he's good in this. It's another case, though, where Mr. Vampire was so successful that it was, I think, perhaps hard or impossible or just not reasonable to try and do anything other than various other vampire films. So Chin went on to do various vampire films that follow loosely in this one's wake. He did other stuff to be sure, including some important roles in big Hong Kong films like Tai Chi Master and Fist of Legend. And he also starred in the 2013 film Rigor Mortis, which I have not seen. I think I almost saw it. Like, I think I rented it and never watched it. And I'm glad that I didn't now, because its whole thing is that it's supposed to be a stylish homage to the old vampire movies, including Mr. Vampire. So I feel like a lot of that would have been lost on me if I just skipped right to the 2013 stylish homage, as opposed to, you know, watching at least Mr. Vampire.
Yeah, better do it in order. We should watch all of the Mr. Vampire sequels, then do Encounters of the Spooky Kind, then watch Rigor Mortis.
Oh, man, I think our eyes might be bigger than our stomach on that one. There's so many.
Yeah.
All right, so that's the handsome one. But then there's also Dan. I think his actual character's name is Man Cho, I think. But the captions and the dubbing refer to him as Dan.
Yeah.
And he's played by Ricky Hu, who lived 1946 through 2011. And this guy is totally our comic relief character, and he's pretty fabulous.
Oh yeah, he's an excellent physical comedy actor. He's got a very funny haircut in the movie. He's got a kind of like one of those sagging bowl cuts that I think is clearly supposed to look funny. And he's the butt of all the jokes. There's a really funny sequence toward the end where he is gradually transforming into a vampire, and in order to prevent the transformation, he has to keep doing all these things like lying on a bed of glutinous rice and continually dancing in a ludicrous fashion.
Yes. Yes. While also having regular freakouts about what's happening to him.
Yeah.
He's great.
He's great.
I mean, he's our Droppo. He's this film's Droppo. He's this film's Perico, to draw back to the Santo picture we discussed.
Well, I was going to generally agree, except I also wonder, is this film's Perico not Billy Lau as Y, the incompetent policeman?
Ultimately, Mr. Vampire is a film with broad
many
enough comedy to have many Pericos, or at least two prominent Pericos. You can have two characters that are performed with a broad physical style of comedic acting that defies all language barriers.
I hope Dan is in all of the Mr. Vampire sequels.
He's actually not. This actor seems to have been successful enough and enough of like a comedy star that he reprised it in the movie Mr. Vampire 1992, but otherwise he doesn't seem to have drunk from the Mr. V well as much as some of the other people involved were. He was in several big comedy blockbusters in Hong Kong back in the 70s and 80s.
Now, the next star in the movie we should probably mention is Moon Lee. And upon looking at her biography, I was very interested because in this movie, she plays a very she is a very passive character. You know, she's the daughter of the rich businessman who is, you know, the beautiful daughter who is the object of love by several characters. But it turns out that she actually had a career mostly doing like stunts and action movies and playing characters who would blow your head off with a big gun.
Yeah, yeah. Moon Lee seems to have largely been an action character. While in this one, she's not. You might be tempted to assume, oh, I guess she's like the damsel in distress, but she's more just the necessary female for comedic interaction.
Yeah, she's not really in distress much. She's mostly like hanging out while other characters just act ridiculous.
Yeah.
Oh, she does play some good pranks in the movie, though. For example, when Master Gao and Dan go to English style tea, to a tea house, to meet with her rich father, the businessman, Mr. Yam, she pranks them by convincing them that they're supposed to drink their coffee and their cream separately because they're not familiar with the conventions of coffee. Oh, and to eat the sugar with the spoon separately.
Oh,
and
yes.
Then when their father comes back, that's what they're doing. And they are quite ashamed.
Yes.
But she did a number of Hong Kong action movies from the 80s through the 90s.
Yeah, a couple that came up for me. And again, I'm not familiar with these pictures, but Fighting Madam from 87, The Avenging Quarter from 1993.
And she was a stunt performer in addition to being an actress. It looks like she ended up doing a lot of, your high octane crime thrillers where she would play a cop with a big gun who hunts down diamond smugglers or something. And in one movie, I found one movie she was in that had a title so good I had to mention it. It's from the year 1990, in which she co-starred with Robin Show. American audiences might know Robin Show best from movies in the 90s like Mortal Kombat, in which he played Liu Kang, or Beverly Hills Ninja. But, you know, he's a longtime actor who did a lot of Chinese action movies and stuff. But the movie they were in together in 1990 is called Fatal Termination.
Ooh.
Moon Lee is also in Mr. Vampire 2 from 1986, which makes me think, again, the sequels might be worth a look. I kind of feel like maybe I'm going to watch all of these sequels if I can get my hands on them. I'm not sure, but it might be worth it. But also I read that, I mentioned that she was also a stunt performer. I think at some point, it was either in the late 80s or early 90s, I read that she was seriously injured performing a stunt for some action movie she was in. Like, she was supposed to jump out of a window, and then there was an explosion that was supposed to happen in the room she was jumping out of, but the pyrotechnics went off early and she was pretty badly burned, but she survived and she's apparently doing fine.
Oh, good. All right, we mentioned this next actor briefly, but Billy Lau plays basically the world's worst policeman.
Yes.
this character, what's his character's name again?
Why?
Yeah.
W-A-I. And he's,
yeah, he shows up at first. Yeah, he's after the love interest played by Moon Lee, but then from there he gets involved in the investigation of vampire related murders and just botches everything he touches. Yes. So I wasn't able to find a birth date for him, but he seems to be still active as of 2019. He did a lot of comedic action roles, including Eastern Condors from 1987. I think that's a Hung production as well. And I think if that's the one I'm thinking of, I may be confused. I think that one might be an ensemble cast that somehow involves a mission to Vietnam. And then Billy Lau also shows up in a number of vampire movies, including Rigor Mortis.
Another tick in that column. Billy Lau is way over the top in this movie, but he's also, he's good. He's very funny. Like I said, this is a movie of many Pericos. And you know what? They play pretty well together. In this, he plays a character with almost every negative characteristic you could imagine. He's just this, like, dumb, incompetent creep.
Yeah, he's great. All right, the next actor of note, Su Fung Wong plays Jade, who we spoiler alert, but we find out she's a ghost. I guess it's pretty clear early on she's a ghost.
Oh, yeah. I think she's from the first. Yeah. She appears being like brought in the forest in a kind of translucent mist, being born by these guys in strange makeup, and then she flies through the air. I think it's clear she's a ghost.
Yeah. So she's an actor producer born 1962, was in a number of films, including Love with the Perfect Stranger from 1985, Web of Deception, 1989, and plus it seems like a fair sprinkling of vampire and supernatural films.
One thing that's funny about her character, so the movie basically has two major supernatural antagonists. One is the main vampire and the other is the ghost played by Su Fung Wong. And these two antagonists kind of are running parallel storylines that are in some cases not even fully intertwined from what I could tell, except that they involve the same characters. But then also there's a funny thing about, so her, when her true form is revealed by Master Gao toward the end of the movie, she wears some exceptionally not good monster makeup that somehow works anyway. It involves a sort of eyeball and a stalk that juts out of her half-rotten face.
Yeah, what was interesting about this to me is that on one level you look at it and you're like, oh, well, they didn't quite pull that off, did they? Mm-hmm. And yet it does kind of work, and it reminds me of the deliberate special effects choices in the famous Japanese haunted house movie House.
Yes.
You know, yeah. Where there was a deliberate choice by the director to have effects that were, I'm not sure how to describe them exactly, because I don't want to say shoddy, but almost, I think, childlike, like it is if you had only children creating the effects or envisioning the effects.
Thinking about the effects in House, I might say in some cases almost kind of stagey,
yeah.
More like the special effects you would see in a good stage production rather than in a movie.
Yeah, that's a good description. So I thought about that, and it made me sort of contemplate the sometimes thin line between the imperfect and the uncanny, you know?
Yeah,
it kind of comes back to the idea of the hopping vampire. Like, on one level, it's ridiculous, but it's also unnatural. It's also uncanny.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, and finally, there is an actor by the name of Hua Yun who plays the vampire, born 1950. I'm going to mention him because he had 193 acting credits, including The Landlord in Kung Fu Hustle from 2004.
Oh, he's the guy with the, when it's revealed that he's a Kung Fu master, spoiler, sorry, he's got the floppy, rubbery body.
Yeah, I think so. It's been a while since I've seen Kung Fu Hustle, but
yeah.
But this guy did stunts in 1972's The Way of the Dragon, starring Bruce Lee and Chuck Norris. So he's been in tons of things.
Have you seen Way of the Dragon? You know that one?
I think this is one I probably saw parts of it on TBS back in the day, but I don't have a clear memory of it.
Bruce Lee had this short but very memorable run of films in the early 70s, maybe the late 60s too. I think maybe the first one was in 70 or so. But most of them are great martial arts action movies, but they're very serious. Way of the Dragon is definitely the most comedy oriented of them. It's the one where Bruce Lee travels to Rome. It actually takes place in Italy because he's got a relative who I think is running a restaurant there that is being menaced by the mafia. And then he comes in to defend it from these mafia thugs. And so they end up recruiting their own fighters, such as Chuck Norris. So they bring in Chuck Norris to defeat Bruce Lee, but Norris doesn't stand a chance. But anyway, that movie is actually quite silly as well, because I remember there's a major subplot in it about Bruce Lee eating too much soup and then having to go pee a lot.
All right. It doesn't influence his style, though, right? It's not
really,
like, you know, later on we'll see like the Drunken Master.
Yeah, Peepee Master. No, it's not Peepee Master.
Okay. Yeah, maybe I haven't seen that one at all. Mainly, I guess the main Bruce Lee movie I've seen is, of course, Enter the Dragon, which is pretty serious.
Yeah. One last thing about Way of the Dragon. Chuck Norris playing this villainous fighter in it has no facial hair, and it's disturbing.
Oh, yeah, yeah, because he is known for the beard and the mustache. Normally, at this point, I mention the music. Well, the music's fine in this. It's not like the music is offensive. But the score is credited to one Melody Bank, which I'm 99% sure is not someone's name. I'm thinking it's just like a storehouse of music. I don't know.
Melody
I could be wrong
Bank.
On that.
That
Melody
sounds kind Bank. Of like it is a database. Or
yeah. And there are only five films credited to Melody Bank on IMDb. Maybe I'm wrong. But the theme music was composed by Alistair Monteith Hodge and California-born Anders Nelson. So if that means anything to you, there you go.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential, and then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own? Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher. I'm so excited to tell you about the brand new series of The Girlfriends. In season one, we told you about the murder of Gail Katz at the hands of my ex-boyfriend, Bob. At one point, a woman's torso washed up on Staten Island and was misidentified as Gail. She spent 9 years in Gail's grave, and then she just disappeared.
It's almost like it's become this moral obligation to find her.
And that's what we're going to do. Find this missing girlfriend and tell her story. With the help of some of your favorite girlfriends from season one, like my producer, Anna.
Oh my God.
my friend Dr. Mindy Shapiro.
Hi, it's Dr. Shapiro, and I'd like to speak with the Deputy Medical Examiner.
And of course, Gail's sister, Elaine Katz.
Having no closure, it kills you.
Join us as we try to solve a 35-year-old cold case. It's not going to be easy, but it's going to be one hell of a ride.
What?
I can't believe this.
Listen to season 2 of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Elliot Connie, and this is Family Therapy.
My best hopes, I guess, identify the life that I want and work towards it.
I never seen a man take care of my mother the way she needed to be taken care of.
I get the impression that you don't feel like you've done everything right as a father. Is that true?
That's true. And I'm not offended by that.
Thank you for going through those things, and thank you for overcoming them.
Thank God for the limits.
Every time I have one of our sessions be positive. It just keeps me going.
I feel like my focus is redirected in a different aspect of my life now.
So, how'd we do today?
We did good.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy. Listen now on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. New year, new name, new energy, but...
same old us.
And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. But that's not all. We will also have special guests to add their thoughts on the topics, as well as break down different political issues with local activists in their community. If you like to be informed, and to expand your thoughts, listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
Now, I guess here we're getting to the part where we would usually go into a full plot breakdown, but I was thinking, we're talking about this today, just to mix it up a bit, I thought maybe rather than going scene by scene in order, I would just sort of lay down the basic plot situation, and then we could mention a few things throughout the runtime that we thought were interesting. But before I get into that, I did want to mention the opening scene in detail.
Oh, yes.
because the opening scene is fabulous. It really is one of the most memorable things about the movie, and it really sets the tone for the movie. So after the credits finish, and the credits, by the way, are great just because they have a wonderful green ooze color to them. But once we finally open on the action, to someone not familiar with the conventions of Jiangxi movies, as I was not really once I started watching this, it's a very WTF kind of opening.
Yeah.
Because we have this guy going around who we find out is one of the assistants of the Taoist priest, but he's going around with a bunch of incense in this room that is just covered in magical amulets and trinkets and pieces of paper with writing on them, things that seem like they have magical significance in one way or another. And he is tending to coffins in this room. At first, I wasn't sure what these objects were, but they are these... it's just these rows of horizontal wooden cylinders. You do find out that they're coffins.
Yeah, and I was not really, I don't know if I'd seen these before, but these are depictions of basically the traditional Chinese style of casket, which looks rather different from the Western style. It's my understanding you still see both used in China. So if you look up, like do a Google image search for Chinese coffins or Chinese caskets, you'll likely see some pictures that include both styles, where you'll see Western variations and then also these more ornate looking traditional coffins that are sometimes described as having humps.
Yeah, the humps, or I was actually thinking about it like petals. Like if you look at them end on, they look kind of like a flower with four petals.
Yeah. Yeah, they're quite beautiful. Though, of course, I can't help but look at a picture of it, and I'm just like, oh, yeah, well, that one has a Western vampire in it,
right?
And this one has a Jiangxi in it. So, and my thinking on that may also be compounded by the fact that I know that there are two or more films in which a Western vampire and an Eastern vampire meet in Chinese cinema.
That's worth looking up.
Yeah.
But I also like that Mr. Vampire does not make you wait to see vampires. It's not like you got to get into the, you know, have all the magic unleashed. It's there right from the opening. So while the assistant is going around doing all this stuff, we see Dan messing around with the incense. he also uncovers, he like peels back a curtain to reveal a boot camp style lineup of swaying unconscious fiends of some kind. Again, if you don't know the conventions of the genre, you're like, you know, WTF, what is this? And they're, again, they're dressed in this Qing Dynasty era clothing with these hats on, and there are yellow strips of paper covered in red writing pinned to their hats so that they hang down over their faces.
Yeah, and these are essentially spells that are binding them and keeping them from running amok.
Yeah, this movie is to suggest, and I guess this is somewhat historically accurate, that a lot of Taoist magic rituals involve like writing a spell on a piece of paper and then doing something with that paper, like eating it or putting it on something.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, I guess it comes down to the magical use of language.
Yeah. And also I noted that the spells tend to be, in I think every case I can think of in the movie, written in some kind of red color, red ink, or in some cases in blood. And that made me think that I do believe it's the case that in broadly in Chinese culture, red is considered a lucky or holy color, right?
Yes.
And in addition to that, there are obviously all these amulets and everything everywhere. And Dan is going around with a bunch of sticks of burning incense. And he's saying to the corpses in the coffins, he's like, here's your dinner, time for supper, and stuffing the incense into the coffins. And he also makes clear that there's a candle burning in front of all the Jiangqi lined up with the spells over their faces, and he can't let the candle go out because if the candle goes out, they will get loose. And he makes clear, he's like, I can't handle all of you, so I've got to keep you, I don't know what, in a trance or whatever it is.
Yeah, so it's an interesting place to start, especially, again, if you have known nothing about the genre, where you have not just a supernatural element, but this kind of magical containment, ongoing magical containment and management of supernatural entities.
Right. They regard these particular vampires that are lined up here, not really with utter terror, but more as like something that, you know, more like something that you would work with on a regular basis. So you're not mortified by it, but also you realize it could be dangerous if you screw up when you're dealing with it.
Right. It's like handling dangerous chemicals or something.
Right. And so he's going around cramming the incense in the coffins. And then there's a really funny part where one of the coffins, like a skull pops out of it and bites him on the hand. So I enjoyed the skull bite. But then there's a good vampire fake out. So the Dan gets attacked by what you think is one of the vampires. It hops at him and menaces him with fangs. But then, oh no, it's like a cat scare. It turns out that it's not really him. It's his handsome buddy in a makeup, I guess, like pranking him.
Yeah, and it comes dangerously close to the film mistake of making your fake monster look a little bit too good.
Well, he really does look exactly like the real ones.
Yeah, so I was a little confused when that happened. But it's not too much longer that you have to wait until you see some more vampires and some of them, some more of the Jiangxi that look better, that look more undead.
But this prank, you know, pranks in horror movies is just a bad idea because it, of course, leads to I don't remember exactly how they do this, but through some klutziness, they end up unleashing all of the Jiangqi. Like they knock the candle over, and then the strips of writing come off of their foreheads, and then they start hopping around attacking them. So of course the bumbling students need help from their master, and these two students that the master they work for is played by Qin Ying Lam. This is Master Gao, the hero of the film. And from the moment you see him, you know he means business. This is the moment when I noticed the unibrow when he first comes in, and I was thinking, like, that's not a funny unibrow. That's a unibrow I respect.
Yeah, he's serious and he knows what he's doing. Like when he starts fixing the problem, it gets fixed. He's fast, he's deliberate, he's got the moves.
Yeah, and speaking of moves, so it turns in, this movie has an interesting combination of magic and martial arts. So a lot of what Master Gao does to fight the vampires is like doing spells and rituals and stuff like that. But other things, but on the other hand, it's also just like fighting. It's, you know, kicks and punches and standard comedy martial arts. Maybe not quite as virtuosic as you'd see in like one of the comedy action movies of Jackie Chan, but a similar kind of vibe that, you know, like funny fighting.
Yeah, yeah. It did remind me of some of the Jackie Chan films I've seen where there'll be a really great and inventive use of some sort of a set piece, like a chair.
Yeah.
There's at least a little of of that in this. And I have to admit, I'm not well-versed enough in Hong Kong action to know if what I'm watching in Mr. Vampire is truly great comedy martial arts, or if it's just like really good, or even just decent. But it certainly feels awesome when I'm watching it on screen. Like these are well thought out action sequences that really zing.
Yeah, same here. I agree. And so there are a lot of funny things to it. Like one of them is that actually when Master Gao comes in, there's another Taoist priest with him, this guy wearing glasses who is at the beginning and the end of the film. And this guy, together, they like, I think what they do is they bite their fingers and make them bleed. And then they use the blood on their fingertips to touch the foreheads of the vampires to essentially pause them, like freeze them in place. And I think, again, this is because of either it's something about the blood or it could have to do with putting the red color on their foreheads. But it's funny because they will have to like pause them and unpause them. So, for example, the other priest at one point, one of the vampires is choking him and he puts the mark on the vampire's forehead and it freezes the vampire. But now it's frozen choking him and he has to wipe it off and unfreeze him so that it'll get his hands off of him and then he can freeze him again.
Yeah, there's a level of attention shown to the action in a film like this. To not even just to say action, but like the physical movements, like every physical movement in one of these scenes is so elegantly choreographed. It's wonderful to watch.
Right, but eventually they fix all the malfunctioning vampires. They fix them with martial arts and magic, and then they send them off with this other priest, the guy wearing glasses. And I was wondering at the beginning, what did this guy like buy a bunch of Jiangshi from Master Gao? But I don't think so. I think actually he's another priest, and I think what's happening is he is taking them off somewhere to be given a proper burial so that they are no longer vampires.
Yeah, that was what I got from it too. Which again, it ties in with what we discussed earlier about the origin of this monster in general. That it emerges from anxiety and concern over the improper burial or the lack of burial for individuals. And so it makes sense that our Taoist priests here are part of the solution. They're trying to get these folks buried, putting the unruly dead to rest.
Yeah, and when he leads them away, like they're hopping.
Yeah.
They've got the spells back on their faces, so they're not hopping of their own accord. They're sort of hopping as directed. They're being obedient now. But other than that, just to give an idea of the main plot situation. So after this, Master Gao is hired by a wealthy businessman named Mr. Yam to help with a strategic reburial of Mr. Yam's dead father. And the story is that a perhaps skeevy or perhaps revenge-oriented fortune teller has prophesied that if Master Yam digs up his father's corpse and buries it in a different place, this will lead to great fortune. And I think this great fortune is to be interpreted as money because he mentions that his business is not doing so well lately. And then it's also worth noting that Mr. Yam has a beautiful daughter named Ting. This is Moon Lee. And then a nephew named Y, who is this guy we mentioned, this odious and just magnificently incompetent police commander, who is also romantically obsessed with his cousin Ting.
Yeah. So he's fabulous.
So Master Gao serves as a kind of ritual magic consultant for the reburial process of Yam's father. And unfortunately, once the body is disinterred, Gao notices the telltale signs of vampirism, that his body is fat and fresh when it should have been decomposed. So it ends up being transported to Gao's magical workshop and sealed shut in its coffin for protection and I guess for him to ultimately figure out what to do with it, maybe find a place to bury it. Mm-hmm. But of course, you know, in a movie like this, no coffin can stay sealed. So the vampire is unleashed, setting off a chain of vampiric infections and transformations. Mr. Yam gets it first. His father comes to him and vamps him. Then he goes on a rampage and so forth. And there's this chain of you know how a vampire movie goes after this.
Yeah.
The structure is very similar to the vampire movies, you know.
Yeah, it's like there's going to be cascading effects leading, emanating out from this master vampire, but eventually you're going to have to deal with that master vampire.
Exactly. Meanwhile, I mentioned there's also this simultaneous plot where the handsome young hero, one of the two assistants, is targeted by a malicious ghost who I think attaches to him after he looks at her tombstone.
I believe so, yes.
Yeah, I've never heard of a ghost targeting somebody in that way before, but that seems to be what happens. He like looks at her tombstone and he hears a voice, and after that she's just creeping on him.
There's this great scene where he's riding by the cemetery, I think, or he's riding through the woods on a, is he on a horse? No, he's not
on
a horse.
He's on a bicycle.
He's on a bicycle.
Yeah.
And she like ghost flies across the forest. It's one of several wonderful wire-based martial arts effects where mm-hmm. she flies through the forest and she lands gingerly right on the back of his bicycle. Like, all right, I'm with you now. Let's go. But then he rides underneath a low-hanging tree branch and he ducks. And then the branch hits her and knocks her off the bicycle. Which of course reminded me of John Carpenter's Big Trouble in Little China, where mm-hmm. We have the Lo Pan, the ghost, the spirit entity, who passes through a vehicle, but then is also we can see that he can pass through things, but he can also be hit by a truck. Very similar in this film, where this ghost has all these ghostly powers, but she can also just run smack into a tree limb.
So I wanted to think for a minute about some of the conventions of these vampire movies, because so in Western vampire movies, you've got the tropes that always appear. You've got the things that can be used to defeat the vampire, like, mm-hmm. Stakes, crosses, garlic, a vampire doesn't show up in a mirror, all those kinds of things. And this universe seems to have similar types of tropes. Like there are things that are used for ritual magical effect against vampires or things that seem to be true of the vampires. And I wanted to try to think about what some of them were. One that I found very interesting was the power of glutinous rice.
Yeah.
This movie uses, Master Gao repeatedly uses sticky rice to ward off vampires or to counteract the effects of a person turning into a vampire when Dan gets vamped.
Yeah, I love this part of the film. On the one hand, it makes perfect sense. It reminds me a lot of what we talked about with the use of beans in some cultures as a way.
Beans, yeah.
Yeah, adzuki beans or other beans in other mm-hmm. cultures used in a way to fight back against the supernatural or having some link to the supernatural. Mm-hmm. So, I love the idea that the sticky rice could be utilized in such a fashion. But this film goes even further by asking the question, well, what happens when an outbreak of vampires in your town or city causes a huge demand for sticky rice? How
yes.
do the local rice shop owners respond? And in this film, they respond crookedly by cutting sticky rice with other varieties of rice.
That was one of my favorite parts of the movie. Yeah, so there's a commodities demand problem. Mm-hmm. You need all the sticky rice to fight vampires, and it turns out regular rice is no good, mm-hmm. does not help you at all. It's got to be sticky rice. And so, yeah, there's a scene where a character is sent to the rice shop to get a whole bunch of sticky rice to fight off the vampire. And an unethical rice shop owner tells his dim-witted son, why don't you mix 30 caddies of regular rice with the 20 of sticky rice? They'll never know the difference.
Yeah.
And so, and I think the dim-witted son gets it wrong, but still does dilute it.
Yeah. And of course, that just causes the whole outbreak to get even worse. So yeah, I definitely love the use of the sticky rice. We already mentioned the spells, but
yeah.
Master Gao uses a number of different like holy relics and artifacts to battle. Mm-hmm. I think my favorite one that he uses against the vampires is the glowing dagger, the
yes.
dagger that is made out of Chinese coins.
And infused by the power of the moon, right? There's a part
That's
where
right,
he like, focuses
yeah.
the power of the moon on it and it makes it glow.
Yeah.
I don't know what the deal with that is, but I thought that was cool.
Yeah. So, I mean, we do see some of the similar ideas, like holy elements involving reflections and light, celestial energy, solar energy in more Western varieties. But the idea that lunar energy could be utilized as well, I like that.
Yeah, but here's one thing. I don't know if you picked up on this seeming contradiction. Maybe I just don't understand. But so one thing is it's implied that the vampires are blind and that mm-hmm. they can only detect you by hearing you, right? And that was the reason that you could hold your breath to hide from the vampire, because if you're not breathing, the vampire can't find you.
Or is it that they smell your breath? Because
oh,
remember there's
the
scene where Dan buys himself a few moments of time to escape, which he doesn't use. He just like gloats, I think, for a second. But he
yeah.
sticks some things in the Jiangxi's nose, in its nostrils.
Oh, that's
right. And
then
right. it can't detect him.
Maybe it is the smell. Yeah. So it's either hearing or smell or some combination thereof. The vampire can't find you if you're not breathing. So characters repeatedly hold their breath for a moment, as the original title says, while the vampire's like looking right in their face. Whatever the effect, it's supposed to not be able to see them. But also I've read that it's supposed to be a convention of these stories that the vampires are afraid of their own reflections in a mirror. And I wondered how that works if they can't actually see. So I'm not sure about that. Maybe it's just something that's not consistent in the lore, or maybe I don't quite understand.
Well, also the master vampire in this seems to be less limited when he comes back after his first initial defeat. Because when he comes back, he looks a bit different. He seems to be looking around with eyes more. He doesn't seem to be as based in scent. So, which raises additional questions about exactly how these beings work. But yeah, he seems to come back more powerful.
So generally in Taoist rituals, is the moon considered a holy thing that can ward off evil? Because I remember there's also a part where when the ghost first appears to try to seduce the handsome young hero in the forest, there's a song that is being sung on the soundtrack. And the translation on the subtitles of the song, there was a line that said, "Who would want a ghostly bride to worship the moon with her?"
Hmm.
I didn't know quite what to make of that, but
well, I mean, the moon has an important roles in Chinese mythology, you know, and is the place of the elixir of the immortals. It is a place where the goddess resides. It is the place where the rabbit lives. I mean, there's a lot of cool magical ideas about the moon is not only like an entity but a place. Mm-hmm. In Chinese mythology, whereas I'm not sure that that there's as much about that with the sun. You know, when you think about prominent solar Chinese myths, I mean, obviously the one that comes to mind is the shooting of the surplus suns out of the sky by the great archer. But in that, it's like it's more like the sun is an entity or multiple entities that must be dealt with. I'm sure I'm missing something. There's a lot. Chinese mythology is a broad tent, and likely there's some exceptions to this that I just don't have in my head at the moment.
I guess we got to wrap up in a minute here, but one more thing I wanted to mention before we did was the excellent jail scene. I loved the jail.
Oh, yes.
So at one point in the movie, Master Gao is framed for the murder of a character. I think it's for the murder of Mr. Yam, the wealthy businessman who hired him. And it goes like this. He shows up when the body is found. And why the incompetent policeman is saying, well, he has holes in his neck, so those must have been caused by a gun. And then everybody's like, wait, that doesn't really make sense. And he's like, oh, yeah, that's right, because the neck is really torn up. And then he's like, well, maybe it was caused by someone who was a martial arts expert who was an expert in the ninefold darts. I don't know what that means, but I tried to look that up and I couldn't find anything about it, so... maybe I was not using the right search terms. But then finally, Master Gao reveals it looks like these holes were actually made by long fingernails, right? So the vampire like sticks long fingernails in the victim's neck. And then why the policeman's like, hey, Master Gao, you have long fingernails. You're under arrest.
Yep.
And then he takes him back to the jail to torture him for information. But while he's in his jail cell overnight and repeatedly getting his head stuck between the bars, the handsome two of his assistants shows up to rescue him. But then the vampire also comes to life, and then Y is running around causing problems as well. There's a great fight scene. That whole part was one of the best parts of the movie.
I agree. But before we go, should we discuss the gorilla scene?
What was that supposed to be, a gorilla? Okay.
Yes, so, I think it was.
Okay. We're setting the scene here. At one point, the police, I guess being led by Y, the world's worst policeman, are out in the countryside. They've left the city, and they're like on a grassy hill, and they find a cave opening. Mm-hmm. And the police go out into the cave opening, I think with their guns drawn, maybe believing that the vampire is in the cave. That's one thing that's interesting in this movie. The police are fully on board with the supernatural villain, and they're ready to go fight the vampire with guns.
Yeah, say what you will about them. Once it's clear that it's supernatural, they're like, all right, yeah, we're on board. We'll do what we need to do. We'll help go find this thing before it gets dark and it becomes more powerful.
But when they go into the cave, chased out by a gorilla.
Yeah, like a guy in a gorilla suit. Yep.
Yeah.
I mean, I haven't really researched it or anything as to what critics have said about it over the years. but based on just a couple of brief mentions, I think this was just included as a gag. It's just like a sight gag of like, what if then a gorilla chased them out of the cave? Wouldn't that be funny? Though it does seem, at least to my, my eyes, and again, I'm not familiar with all, you know, everything that would have been considered like normal within comedy at the time, like what makes a normal action comedy in mid 1980s Hong Kong cinema. So maybe this isn't that far out of line to have a sudden gorilla gag show up, but it felt out of line. It felt like where did that come from? I almost feel like I'm part of one of those gorilla costume experiments where they're checking to see if you're paying attention to the scene.
A well deployed random gorilla is a good trick.
Yeah. So that scene is just really that's a really crazy sequence that doesn't have huge bearing on the plot.
No,
I guess that's the other thing. It doesn't really connect to any other sequence, so you can sort of compartmentalize it as just one of the police chief's wacky adventures.
Have you ever seen the movie Ape? I think it's just called Ape. It's a bad ripoff of King Kong. It's just a giant ape movie. But the main thing I remember about it, it's been a long time since I saw it. The main thing I remember is there's a scene where a guy in a gorilla costume just gives the middle finger to the camera for a solid 15 seconds.
Oh, I have seen that sequence. I believe there was an old film titled "It Came from Hollywood" that Dan Aykroyd and John Candy and a number of folks did, and it had a lot of clips from old films. And they had a whole section on gorilla movies that was pretty fabulous. And I remember that ape. I definitely remember that ape.
Okay, I think maybe we got to call it there for Mr. Vampire.
Yeah, but hopefully we've raised everyone's interest level regarding Mr. Vampire. I it's definitely worth seeking out. I didn't look around much for this. I think there are some rips of it out there, but I can't speak to the quality. There have been various DVD and Blu-ray releases over the years. The DVD version is the one that we watched. We rented it from Atlanta's own Videodrome, the last video rental store here in Atlanta. But I think you can buy copies of it. I think it's commercially available. And I have seen it on streaming services before, just I don't think currently. But this stuff changes, so who knows? It may become, perhaps there's, and it's also possible that there's maybe a Hong Kong cinema-centric service that I'm just not privy to that would be the ideal place to go for your Mr. Vampire and Mr. Vampire related titles.
If you do end up watching it, be warned in advance about content. It's just worth reading about a bit. There's one thing that came to my mind, which is that there are a couple of scenes in the movie where it appears that real animals are killed on screen. Like there's a chicken and a snake, I think.
Yeah.
Like they use a dead snake for something.
Yeah. I think I read that the snake that they used was then made into a soup, which I guess is partially comforting. But yes, be aware. But then again, I think it's a good idea if you're looking at some of these older movies.
Just be aware in general.
Yeah. IMDb has been pretty good for me recently on selections where they have the parental guidance section, which I used to just not care about, but especially as a parent now I care about it. But also in terms of selecting things for Weird House Cinema, it's a great way on at least more well-known films to just just check in and see what has been flagged. And sometimes it's hilariously fun where someone will be like, well, it is implied that a human is naked in this film. It is not shown, but it is heavily implied. So beware. So I love some of the warnings that are just a bit over the top like that. But then you can also, you know, find out if there are, you know, examples of potential animal cruelty or depicted animal cruelty that you just might not want to watch, even if it, even if no animals are harmed. Sometimes you don't want to see the fictional version of something either. Yeah. So I've had good luck with the IMDb parental guidance section.
Good idea. Use as needed.
Use as needed. All right, we're going to go ahead and close the coffin on this one and give it a proper burial. But who knows? Maybe in the future we'll be back with more Jiangxi action. I have to admit there is at least one title that has been on my list since the beginning of Weird House Cinema. We may come back to. Weird House Cinema, of course, is our Friday episode that we put out in the Stuff to Blow Your Mind podcast feed. We're normally a science and culture podcast, and our core episodes publish on Tuesdays and Thursdays. We do a little bit of listener mail on Mondays. We do The Artifact on Wednesdays, which is a short form episode. But then Friday is Weird House Cinema. And you can find all of this wherever you get your podcast. Just look for the Stuff to Blow Your Mind podcast feed. If you want to get to it quickly, you can go to stufftoblowyourmind.com. That will send you over to the iHeartRadio page for our show. And there's actually a store button on there. You can go there if you want, and you can buy some Stuff to Blow Your Mind merch, and you can actually buy some Weird House Cinema merch now. As of this recording, the only thing available is a sticker or a magnet, but I'm hoping that we get a shirt in there soon. We just have to get some other sort of file for that to work properly. So at any rate, check that out if you're interested.
Huge thanks, as always, to our excellent audio producer, Seth Nicholas Johnson. If you would like to get in touch with us with feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, or just to say hello, you can email us at contact@stufftoblowyourmind.com.
Stuff to Blow Your Mind is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher, back with another season of the global number one podcast, The Girlfriends. Last time, we investigated the murder of Gail Katz. This time, we're uncovering the identity of the woman who was buried in Gail's grave for a decade before she disappeared. Join me and the rest of the club as we tell her story. Listen to season two of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
As important as choosing the right destination when traveling is choosing the right travel partner.
Gene! Gene Fodor!
Gene, what's good?
But be careful, because the worst trips result when two partners have two different agendas.
The CIA really need your help, Gene.
Freeze, Americano! Huh? Oh!
Gene, run!
Listen to Fodor's Guide to Espionage on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robey,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
I am so excited about this podcast, The Bright Side. You guys are giving people a chance to shine a light on their lives, shine a light on a little advice that they want to share.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.